that was an 8.
Hey, that was 8 bars.
I got 7 more bars to show these rappers I'm great. I mean, I took over the game at an immaculate pace. You see all these racks that I made, got a staggering rate. I knew I had a classic before they mixed and mastered my tape.
You're listening to CKUT. The following is a previously broadcast program. Stay tuned.
Al-Hara.
Africa unite, Batsile Lille. Africa unite, Batsile Lille.
Sumumaz Elezer.
Evening and welcome to Amanda, 1 hour of African current affairs brought to you here on CKUT 90.3 FM for 36 plus years. And I say that for a reason. There are a bunch of people in the studio right now. We have Roberto with his two adorable mini little children, Milan and Elio, Sama, Clara Swan, Fabrice, Malud,
and Doug Miller.
Gwen Shulman. Few of us have been doing this all 36 years, or maybe one of us, but a lot of us have been doing this for a long time.
We're going to be talking about disability and preparedness. We're going to be talking about COVID abandonment. And we're going to be talking about like a lot of the questions that, you know, like a lot of the questions that people write us to talk about that they have about preparedness. And I think that we can cover a lot of those, not me, but our guest. But first, before the guest, a jingle from another show on the network. Oh, the network is called Channel Zero Network. It is a network of anarchist podcasts. And here's a jingle. Da-da-da-da.
The Final Straw is a weekly anarchist radio show.
It's fucking awesome, and you're never going to hear me say fucking awesome on our show because right. We're FCC regulated.
There's a black part of my heart that just flutters when you talk like that.
Talk, then more yelling.
It's a weird sort of like nice thing in a way, but also can get kind of crushing at times.
TheFinalStrawRadio.noblogs.org.
Okay, and we're back. So, if you could introduce yourself with your name, your pronouns, and then I guess just like a little bit about how you got involved in thinking about and dealing with disability and preparedness.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Hi, my name is Leah Lakshmi Piepchna Simarsinga. I use she and they pronouns. Right now I live in Pecumtuk and Nipmuc territories in Western Massachusetts. And that is a great question. I will also just plug myself briefly and be like, I'm a disability justice and transformative justice, old sea hag, aging punk of color who has written or co-edited 10 books and done a lot of shit. Okay, so when I was sitting on the toilet thinking about what do I want to tell Margaret when we get on the show, I was actually thinking that my disability and my preparedness roots are kind of one and the same because so I'm 48 now and I got sick when I was 21, 22. So like back in 96, 97. And it was like the initial episode that I got sick with chronic fatigue, ME, and fibromyalgia. And mm-hmm. I was just super fucking ill and on the floor and was living in Toronto as somebody who was not from Canada and, you know, was just like sick as hell, like crawling to the bathroom, like sleeping 18 hours a day, the whole nine. And I'd been really, really deeply involved in anarchist of color and prison abolitionist and anti-fascist organizing and lots of stuff. I had a big community, but it was 1997. So most of my community was just like, what? You're sick? Why didn't you make it to the meeting? We have to write all the prisoners with the soaked stamps. And I was just like, I just, okay, great. Like, it was a really different time. There was no like GoFundMe, mutual aid, meal train, someone bring me some soup. Like, you know, it was just, we weren't really doing that. And people really did not have a consciousness around you can be a 22-year-old brown non-binary femme and be really, really sick and be disabled. So something I think a lot and I've said before is that disabled people are really used to the concept that no one is going to save us. And we are really not surprised when state systems abandon us because we live in that all the time. And so I was this like little 22-year-old sicko weirdo who'd read my Octavia Butler. And in fact, that was part of the reason why it was like, Toronto, great. There's going to be more water and like less heat. Okay, I wasn't totally right about that. But, you know, I mean, I really had to save myself. And I kind of was like, all right, I don't have, like, I'm working under the table. I have hardly any money. I'm going to make my own herbal medicine. I'm going to grow a lot of what I eat from my backyard. I'm going to store water. I'm going to run a credit card scam and get a lot of dry goods and like live off of those for like a year. Yeah, stuff like that. I feel like from there over like the last, you know, 26 years, like it's like, that's the root. Like the root was, you know, similar to a lot of people, I think of my generation, we were like on the cusp of looking at the current crises of like hot fascist war, hot eugenics war, hot climate crisis, and being like, it's coming. And I started being like, yeah, like don't think that it's all going to work out okay and that somebody else is going to fix it for you. So I would say that's where like my initial route. And then do you want to jump in or can I jump ahead like 20 years or something?
Honestly, you could jump ahead 20 years. Later, okay. I'm going to come back and make you talk more about Octavia Butler, but we'll do that later.
Let's talk more about Octavia Butler, because I have a lot of stuff about Octavia Butler and how she thought of, and I think sometimes misused, like nowadays, and also about disability. Yeah, I know, we can fix that. So, okay, so that's one route. And then, you know, I mean, I was always kind of like a little weirdo where I was like, yeah, I grow most of my own food or as much as I can. And it's not like a fun green hobby. It's like, I'm broke as fuck and I need to like grow a lot of vegetables that fucking, you know, I can mulch and that can stay growing into December. You know, I stash stuff. Something I also think a lot is that as disabled people, and we talked about this a little bit when we were emailing, I think we're always prepping whether we call it that or not. Like most disabled folks I know just do shit. Like if you get a prescription and you have extra, you store it, you know, like if you can get a double dose, like you put that aside and then maybe you have it for yourself. Or there's so many disabled mutual aid networks I've been a part of where someone's, I mean, before Facebook clamped down, this is really common on a lot of Facebook disabled groups. Someone would be like, yo, like, does anyone have an extra 5 pills of such and such? And I've seen total strangers for 15 years of disability justice be like, yep, what's your address? I do. I'm going to mail it to you.
Yeah.
I have my old pain meds. I've got this. I've got that. But yeah, like doing the jumping forward that I promised you. So for people who don't know, like disability justice as a movement was founded around 2005 by a group, small group of disabled Black, Asian, and poor and working class white disabled folks who are all pretty, you know, gay, trans, and radical. And they were like, we want to bring a revolutionary intersectional out of our own lives and experiences and issues. We want to create a disability movement that's for us and by us. It's not just like white, single issue, often cis, often male, often straight. Like we want to talk about the fact that 50% of BIPOC folks who are killed by the cops are also disabled, deaf, neurodivergent, et cetera. Like just to give one example. So, you know, that was 05 in Oakland, you know, Patty Byrne, Leroy Moore, Stacey Milburn, Eli Clare, Sebastian Margaret, Stacey Milburn Park, you know, the six. And I was living in Toronto and I moved to Oakland in 07 and I was kind of around for some of the beginnings of it. There's two stories I want to bring in. One actually predates my move. It was right when I was getting ready to leave Toronto. I got invited to go to this like reading by a bunch of like queer, I think all white disabled, like radical folks. And I was just like, oh, and I did the whole, like, am I really disabled enough? And then I was like, oh, it's going to be really depressing. And then it was really awesome. And I was like, whoa, disability community, life-saving. But it was kind of one of my moments of being brought into disability community, because there was this writer who was there who their reading series was actually a choose your own adventure where there's four disabled queer and trans folks uh-huh. having a sex party, and then the zombie apocalypse happens, and then they have to figure out how to survive it without abandoning each other. And it was all like, okay, you all get to the van, but then there's no ramp. What do you do? Oh, you get to this accessible ramp, but it smells like perfume and somebody has MCS. Like, what do you do? And I was just sitting there with my mouth open, and there was also interwoven with like, yeah, and then somebody's fucking somebody else with like, you know, a dildo strapped to their prosthetic. And I was like, wow, I fucking love disability, like sign me up. But I gotta say briefly, that was one of my first examples of like, you know, there's a really important phrase in disability justice, which is no one left behind, right? Yeah. Like that's one of the core organizing principles. And that was kind of, before I even heard that phrase, I was like, fuck, like this is, because I'd been around anti-authoritarian, quasi-prepper, like shit's mm-hmm. going to happen. We have to get make ready. But I was always kind of like quietly in the corner closeting my disability, being like, well, shit, like what if I don't have my meds, or what if I'm too, what if I right. can't run away from, you know, the Nazis or the zombies because I have a limp and I walk with a cane? Like, what if? And that was my first example of like this cross disability fantasy space of like, we're going to escape together and we're not going to let anyone get eaten. And it's going to mean really being creative about access stuff. Okay. Yeah. So jump ahead to, right. Okay. So then I moved to Oakland, and then I run into actual disability justice community through Sins Invalid, which is an incredibly important foundational disability justice group. And through a lot of friendships I started making with other cutie BIPOC disabled folks. And my really, really good friend, Stacey Park Milburn, who if people should totally know her work, she's incredible. She was one of the best movement organizers that the movement has ever seen. And we met online, and she was living in Fort Bragg, North Carolina, with her family on the base because her family's military. Mm-hmm. And she was a queer Southern working class, Korean and white, you know, physically disabled organizer from when she was really young. And then she was like, okay, I love my family, but I'm literally hiding my gay books in the wall because my mom's Pentecostal. So yeah. So, and she was like, I literally realized, like, she tells the story a lot. She's like, yeah, like I realized I hadn't really left the house for a couple months, and like, this is going to be it. And she's like, I was literally watching Oprah, and Oprah said, no one's going to coming to save you. And she was like, okay, she's 21 years old. Uh-huh. And then through online disabled queer of color community, she organized this initiative called To the Other Side of Dreaming, where she moved cross country with Mia Mingus, who's another queer Korean organizer, who was a friend of hers.
Okay.
And moved to the Bay Area. And so that was around 2010, 2011. And then in 2011, what happens but the Fukushima nuclear accident, right? Disaster.
Yeah.
And we're all on the West Coast, and it's completely ridiculous bullshit looking back on now, but like all of these Bay Area folks were like, oh my God, radiation. And some people pointed out, look, you know, we're not, there's, it's a big ocean. The people who really have to worry are in like Japan and like areas around it. So yeah, whatever. But it was one of those times where we were like, fuck, this is a really big nuclear accident. And we are sort of close, and it's making us think about disaster. And I remember just going to the fucking Berkeley Bowl, which is this big fancy organic supermarket. And like, people had bought out all of the burdock and all of the fucking seaweed. And I was like, oh my God, these people. But out of that, like, Stacey started having and I and other people who were in our organizing network of disabled majority BIPOC were like, what are we going to do as disabled BIPOC if there is, like, you know, an earthquake, fascism, yeah, like another big disaster? And Stacey said really bluntly, she's like, you know, and she was a wheelchair user. She used a ventilator. You know, she's like, yeah, I am supported by electricity and battery, you know, dependent like access equipment. And she's like, well, I'm going to be really honest. My plan has always been, if something happens, I'm just going to lay down in my bed and die, because I don't think that any emergency services are going to come save me, and the power is going to run out in 48 hours. And then we were like, okay, bet, that's super real. What if through our amazing collective access stuff we're doing, we could figure out something else? And we had this meeting at Arizmendi Bakery, which for folks who know is like a worker-owned co-op chain. Like, our friend Remedios worked there. It's wheelchair accessible. We met there after hours. And it was just like 12, 15 of us who started just sitting there and being like, what are the resources we have? What are the needs we have? Yeah. And we made this map, which I still have, which I think I shared with you, which is just like apocalypse South Berkeley / Oakland map, yeah. 2011, where we were like, okay, you know, when the power goes down and communication goes down, we're going to meet at this one traffic circle because people who are wheelchair users can roll up, and we're going to bury note paper in a mason jar with pens, and we're going to leave notes for each other, but we're also going to agree to meet there the day after at noon. And I was like, okay, my collective house, like the first floor is wheelchair accessible. We have solar, we have a landline. Mm-hmm. So like, and we have a lot of space. So like, let's meet there. And then someone was like, we've got the one accessible van and we know it's only supposed to fit 4 people, but we can fit like 12 in there. And we started, like, I just think about that a lot because I think it was a really important moment where it was important, the stuff that we did, like the, you know, the actual strategies and the resources we started talking about, but it was also that, it was the first time in my life that I was like, okay, we're not only are we not going to just die alone in our beds, I'm also not going to be the one person who survives. Like, I can actually survive with and because of other people. And we're all disabled BIPOC with like a couple of disabled white folks. And we can like actually collectively strategize around that. And then, and this will be my last leap forward because I see that you're like, I want to ask you stuff. So, you know, 8 years go by, and like in that time, like we all do an incredible amount of like disability justice organizing and strategizing. And, you know, in 2019, and a lot of it started to be around climate disaster on the West Coast. Like I moved to Seattle in 2015, the wildfires started getting really bad a year or two later. A lot of us were involved in mass distributions and just spreading information about like smoke safety and, you know, survival. And then in 2019 was the infamous year where the wildfires came back and Pacific Gas and Electric in all of its fucking glory, which is the main, for people who don't know, it's the main like utility electrical company in Northern California. They announced 2 days before wildfires were going to really impact the Bay. They were like, oh, so we've decided that, you know, our strategy is going to be, we're just going to shut down all the power in Northern California. And
no one uses that.
No one uses that. And they were like, oh, if you have like a medical need, call this number and we'll make sure to like leave it on at your house. And Stacey was like, she's like, okay, yeah. She had just bought her house, the Disability Justice Culture Club in East Oakland, you know, which was like her house, but also a community center, de facto community center that housed a lot of disabled folks of color. And she was like, I was on the fucking phone for 8 hours. Like I never got through. And she and some comrades started this campaign called Power to Live, where they were like, it started out as like, okay, we can't save everybody, but we're not going to just lay down and die. What do we do? So it started out as like, okay, let's identify like who has housing that still has power. There's some people in Richmond, there's some people in this neighborhood. But then it also developed into this thing where it was just this amazing crowdsourced survivalist resource where it was everything from, she's like, here's a number, here's an email. If you need something, text us, call us, email us. We have a team of 8 people. We'll figure it out. If you have something to offer, do it too. And then some of it was that people were like sharing everything from like generator information to generator shares to people in different areas. Like I was in Seattle and we were like, okay, we will mail you generators and air purifiers because it's obviously all sold out in the Bay, but we can get it here and get it to you. To the thing that always stands out to me is people being like, oh yeah, here's how you can use like dry ice and 2 clay pots to keep your insulin cold if refrigeration goes down.
Yeah.
And there's a lot more I could say about that action and how amazing it was. But for me, when I think about the through line, I'm like, that moment in 2011, when we all got together and we're like, what do we do? We were prepping for what we couldn't fully predict, you know, the exact manifestation of, but 8 years later, we're there and we're like, okay, there's wildfires, there's smoke, there's no fucking power. Yeah. And we've not only built our organizing base, we've built our relationships with each other so that we can actually trust each other and more or less know how to work together when this shit actually is hitting the fan to create something that's really life-giving.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll shut up. That was a lot.
Okay, but now I have so many questions about all of it.
Yeah, ask me all the questions.
Because there's a couple like questions and or feedback that we get with Live Like the World is Dying a lot. And some of them are very specifically disability related. And you covered most of them, but I want to like highlight some of them. Like a lot of people write and are like, well, I rely on the following thing that is provided by civilization, so my plan is to lay down and die. Right? This is a... And so I guess like, I know you've kind of answered it, but I want to ask more. Okay. Well, I'll go through all the things. Okay. So it's like to talk more about what No One Left Behind means. And then the other thing that really stands out to me is that you know, when we were talking about what we were going to talk about on this episode, I was, you know, saying, okay, we're going to talk about, like, you know, making sure that preparedness is inclusive and open, you know, like, includes disabled folks or whatever. And you pointed out really usefully the necessity to reframe it. And I think that the story you just gave is a really beautiful example of this, where it's less about, like, hey, make sure to pay attention to the people who need canes, you know, or whatever, right? Like, you know, people, make sure you keep track of folks based on disability. And more the, like, well, you all, like the thing you just described is the thing that we're always trying to push, which is that you need to make a list of all the resources and needs within your community and then figure out how to meet those needs. Instead of assuming that we can't meet those needs, figuring out how to actually do it. And so I love that it's actually, like, it's actually disability justice movements that we should be learning from. I mean, or participating right. in, depending on our level of ability or whatever.
Right.
But, like, and so I just find that, I find both of those things really interesting. And so I wonder if you have more that you want to say about, like, alternatives to laying down and dying, and specifically mm-hmm. to tie into the other thing that I get asked the most, or that I get the common feedback is, because we talk a lot about the importance of community for preparedness on this show. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't feel like they have community. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people write to be like, I don't have any friends, or I yeah. don't know any other people like me, or, you know, and so I guess that's my main question is how do
okay. So how do you make community when you don't have community? Alternatives to lying down and dying. Mm-hmm. And was there a third one in there?
I was just highlighting how cool it is that you all, like, sat there and made a list of resources and needs, which is exactly what, like, instead of deciding things are impossible, just being like, well, let's just start mm-hmm. doing them, you know?
Well, and I think, okay, so I'll start there. Like, I think that, like, you know, like Corbett O'Toole, who's, like, a, you know, disability rights movement veteran and, like, older Irish disabled dyke, you know, in Crip Camp, the movie, she's like, disabled people live all the time with the knowledge that the society wants us to, thinks we're better off dead. Right. Yeah. Like, one back in the day, like, you know, they're still active. One of the big disability rights direct action organizations was called Not Dead Yet. Right.
Hell yeah.
And so I think this is the thing, is, like, I think that sometimes abled people or neurotypical people mm-hmm. are not used to, like, sitting down and making the list. And I think that even if, like, disabled people aren't preppers, we're used to being like, okay, what do I need? I need somebody to help me do my dishes. I can't bend over. I need to figure out, like, what is the yeah. access tool that will allow me to pick up something from the floor when my back goes out? Like, if my attendant doesn't show up, can I have a, you know, like, my friend's always like, yeah, I've got a yogurt container by the bed in case my attendant doesn't show up, so I can, like, not piss the bed. I can lean over and piss in the yogurt container. Like, and I think that, God, I mean, there's been so many times over the years where, like, I've done or been a part of doing, like, Disability Justice 101, and me and Stacy would always talk about, like, Crip wisdom and Crip innovation, and people would just look blank. Like, what are mm-hmm. you talking about? You guys are just a bunch of, like, sad orphans at the telethon. And the thing, it's about making the list. It's also about, like, disability forces you to be innovative. Like, Stacy yeah. would always share this story where she's like, yeah, like, she's like, Crip innovation is everything from, she's like, I save a lot of time sometimes by pretending I can't talk when people come over and want to pray over me. You know, I just act like I'm mute and they fucking leave and I go on with my life. Or she's like, you know, I realized one day if I took my sneakers off, I could ramp a step. If it's just two steps, I could just put in there and I could roll up. Uh-huh. Or, I mean, there's a million examples. Or, like, because I think it's about prepping and about making the list. And it's also about whatever you prep for, there's always going to be the X factor of, oh, we didn't fucking expect that. And I think that's yeah. where a lot of prep falls apart, is people have their, like, dream bunker. They're like, oh, okay, I know exactly what the threats are going to be. And then, of course, it doesn't fucking happen that way. I really yeah. hope I can swear on your show.
Yes, you can. Don't worry.
Okay, great. Okay. So, like, I mean, one example I could give is, like, I'm remembering at, you know, a Sins show when we were in rehearsal, where everyone drove over from Oakland in Patty's wheelchair accessible van, and then the ramp broke and wouldn't unfold. So we just mm-hmm. were like, all right, who do we know who has welding equipment? Who do we know who has lumber? Like, I think we ended up going to, like, a bike repair shop, and then they had tools. Yeah. And then we're like, okay, we'll just bring the rehearsal into the van and do it that way. Like, you have to be innovative, and that's a muscle that I think society doesn't teach you to flex, and that often I think that even people who, I think there can be a lot of eugenics in PrEP, you know, mm-hmm. whether people are overtly fascist or not, there's a real belief of like, oh, only the strong and smart, which looks a certain way, survive. And that we right. can use like rational thinking to like make it all work out. And I think a lot of CRIP intelligence or wisdom is like actually knowing that like shit can go sideways 48 different ways and you have to adapt and you yeah. have to just kind of be like, well, let's try this. So I think that's one thing. And I think, you know, one thing I'll say is like, yeah, just speaking to kind of the reframing we were talking about, like, mm-hmm. yeah, I think it's less like, oh, remember the people with canes. Like, I mean, that's good. Yeah. But also like knowing that like we're already doing it and that abled people actually have a shit ton to learn from us. But yeah. also, I mean, something that, I mean, the title of my last book is The Future is Disabled. And it comes from something, it's not unique thinking to me. It's something that a lot of disabled people have been thinking and saying throughout the pandemic is like, we were already at like a 30% disabled world minimum. And we're pretty close. We're probably at majority disabled right now because yeah. what, 2% of the world didn't get COVID. Like how many people have long COVID? How many people have complex PTSD? We're all sick, crazy, and, you know, yeah. needing access equipment. So like, disability is not out there. It's in here. Like there's no such thing as doing PrEP that's like, oh, only the three Ubermensch are going to survive. Like, fuck that.
Yeah.
And that actually, I mean, sorry, this might be a side note, but like, okay, a lot of people have probably seen The Last of Us and I'm just going to spoiler alert it. You know, that famous episode 3 of those two gay bear preppers in love.
Yeah.
Yeah. I loved a lot about it. I was so pissed at the ending, which I'm just going to spoil. So, you know, the like more yeah, artsy non-prep guy. Well, no, but like not only do they not survive, okay. but like one of them gets chronically ill.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I was just like grinding my teeth because it's like, oh, he's in a wheelchair. Oh, his hand tremors. And then they end up deciding to like both kill themselves yeah. rather than do anything else. And I was so furious at it because I was yeah. like, these are two people who are so innovative. They have figured out all kinds of problem solving. They have an entire small city to themselves. And it's all like, oh no, he can't get up the stairs. And I'm like, really? There was no accessible ranch house you couldn't have fucking moved to?
Yeah, or like build a bedroom on the fucking ground floor.
Yeah, or like you couldn't get meds. You couldn't, I mean, when his hand was shaking, and yeah. it was like, oh, it's so sad he's being fed. I'm like, there's tons. First of all, it doesn't suck to be fed. A lot yeah. of things that seem like a fate worse than death are not when you're in them. And also there's like all kinds of adaptive utensils that they could have fucking raided for medical supply if he wants to feed himself. Or like, he, right. I'm sorry, there's no cans of Ensure. They absolutely have power. They couldn't have made smoothies. Like, what the fuck is this? But beyond that, like, and I think that like, a lot of people who talked about that episode did, I think, have some good analysis of it where, mm-hmm. you know, the whole way they'd set up their prep was they were like, oh, it's just the two of us. And the one super prepper guy was like, I don't even want friends to come over. And the other guy was like, hey, actually, like, we need to make alliances because there's things they have that we don't. And we also need more than just the two of us because I love you, yeah. but I'm going to kill you. And I think that's something to think about is like really moving away from the idea that like just your little, you know, the utopic queer rural community that so many fucking city queers fantasize about.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you and your lover are going to be enough because I'm just like, it's not. So no. that actually leads me to like, I don't have community. Where the fuck do I get it? And I'm like, yeah. that's super real. Right.
Yeah.
And I think like, it's something I actually wrote about in The Future is Disabled is that like, I have people be like, when I write about different CRIP communities, just even when I talk about stuff on Facebook, like my friend Graham Bach, it's going to be his second year death anniversary in like 2 weeks. And he was like, you know, white psychiatric survivor, super poor, amazing sweetheart of a human being. He died. I mean, he died in his, you know, rent geared to income apartment because he was really afraid to go to the hospital and he had cardiac stuff going on. And yeah. He was an anarchist. He was an amazing, kind, complicated human being. And I was writing about like, I'm going to tell the story and there's a couple things I want to pull out of it. So
okay.
I was writing about meeting Graham when I was in my early 20s through radical mad people community. And somebody was reading it and was like, that sounds so great. And I was like, yeah, it wasn't utopic. Like I had to yell back at Graham because he would scream at me and I'd be like, shut the fuck up. Like there was yeah. so many fights. There was so much racism. There were so many like older white cis dudes who had electroshock who were jerky or like gross, you know? And I guess that was the thing is I was like, they were like, well, how did you find each other? And I was like, it wasn't perfect. also, it was very analog working class. Like my friend Lilith Finkler, who is an amazing Moroccan Jewish working class queer femme psych survivor, she would just go to the donut shop where everybody poor hung out and would talk to everybody who was there who was crazy, who no one wanted to talk to, and be like, hey, do you want to come hang out at this meeting at the fucking legal clinic? We have a room, we have a snack plate, I'll give you tokens. Yeah. Let's organize. So I think that's the first thing, is that it's not, and I don't mean this in a finger wagging way, it's not automatic. And also, one of the really big ways that community is often ableist and that a lot of us get cut out from it is that, like, yeah, a lot of us who need it the most are not particularly easy to love in ableist neurotypical worldviews. Like, we're cranky, we're wounded, we're in a bad mood, we're weird. So a lot of the time, I think it's thinking about, like, first of all, like, what's one step, one move you can take towards it? Like, can you make one fucking acquaintance and build it? And, like, really think about what it would mean to build some kind of relationship. I think the other thing that I really want to highlight is, like, a lot of the communities that I see that keep each other alive, that I'm lucky to have been a part of making and be supported by in disabled community, they're not static and they're not perfect. Like, I have networks of people who piss me the fuck off and who, you know, I've sent $20 to people who I'm just like, I really don't like you, but I can see that you really don't have food, you know? And we're not going to be friends and we're not going to like each other, but like, I don't want you to die. And like, that's not, I mean, it's bigger. There's people also who I'm like, okay, you're my ex-abuser. I'm not going to give you $5. Someone else can give you $5.
There's this person who like puts a lot of their effort into talking shit on me on the internet. And they're also broke and have a lot of chronic health issues, and I send them money every month.
Yeah.
And every now and then I'm like, could you stop talking shit now?
And yeah, no, I think sometimes it is a thing of like, hey, how about this as a deal? Like, maybe you just say thank you, or maybe just talk shit even like 20% less, because you know, like, we keep us safe here, and I just really would like a thank you.
I don't want you to die, like, but you know, I don't want you to starve to death. But I really wish you would be a little bit more open-minded to people having different opinions than yours.
Oh, God, that'd be nuance, right? Yeah, it'd be fucking nice.
God forbid. Anyway.
Yeah, so I guess, no, it's good. But, like, I guess, like, my TLDR would be start where you are and start with, like, what's one thing you can do? What's one person you can reach out to? And I think, I don't know if this is true for everyone who reaches out to you and is like, well, I don't have anybody. But I think that, you know, social media and online connectivity is a real double-edged sword, because for some of us who are isolated, it can create both like online communities and that can sometimes become in real life communities, and either way can be sources of some community or support. But I think, I mean, you know, I'm a Generation Xer, and I've just seen social media get more and more chokeholded and just turn into fucking the Panopticon meets a mall, you know? And I think that, like, it's hard because, like, I mean, 12 years ago, like, I was part of like really early online disabled spaces, which were great because it was so many people were like, whoa, I'm so isolated in my small town or in my city, or I can't leave bed, but this is great. I'm meeting with other people and like we're building these connections, and like it's actually more accessible for me to like be real about my stuff from like my bed with a heating pad. And now I just think like it's so chokehold that it's hard for us to find each other. Yeah. So it's much more common for people to be like, wow, I'm seeing all these people who have millions of followers and a shiny brand, and I just feel like even more of an isolated loser.
Yeah.
And then at the same time, I think people were like, well, how did people meet each other before this? And I was like, yeah, like you go to like the coffee shop or the donut shop, you put up a flyer, you like go to the library, you like, I don't know. I mean, I just remember people I met on the food stamps line, you know, when we got there at 6 a.m. and like, not everything's going to stick, but maybe something sticks. And I also think about like, I'm going back to like, like 13 years ago in like early disability justice community spaces where, I mean, I think back to stuff where when I went back to Toronto, which big city, but I remember I had so many people come to me and be like, because I was starting to be more out about disability, because I was like, I'm in the Bay and there's these wild people who talk about it and they're not all white people. And so I'd have like so many like, especially like Black and brown disabled femmes be like, hi, you don't really know me, but I have fibromyalgia too, or I have lupus too. And like, no one I know talks about that. And like, how do you do it? And I'm specifically thinking about this time that this person I'm no longer in touch with, but we used to be friends, who's like, you know, queer, brown, non-binary person, was like, let's just like have a meetup of other chronically ill femmes of color, which is, you know, how we were all identifying at the time. And it was like four of us, four heating pads, a bottle of Advil, and just like very tentatively starting to share things about our lives. And I was like, yeah, that was four people. But a lot of that just like hangout then rippled outward. And it was like, I think it's also important to be like, it's scary to build community.
Yeah.
Some tools I want to shout out, like, so Mia Mingus, who I mentioned before, like she has a lot of really great writing on her blog, Leaving Evidence, and she created this tool a long time ago, I don't know, that some people might be familiar with, but for folks who aren't, it's, you know, it's her tool that she calls pod mapping. And she actually created it as part of a collective she founded called the Bay Area Transformative Justice Collective that was working on doing transformative justice interventions into intimate violence, specifically childhood sexual abuse a lot of the time. And she had this framework that I find really helpful. She's like a lot of, she was talking about in like community accountability, transformative justice spaces. She made a really good point where she's like, sometimes we talk about it like, yeah, bring in the community. Like everyone has a community. And she's like, most people don't have a fucking community, right, let alone one that can interview in childhood sexual abuse. So she used to create this tool where she's like, let's broaden the idea of what community is. Like maybe it's like that one cousin that you only talk once a year, but you could call them in a jam, or it's this hotline, or it is like, yeah, they're a weird church, but you really like their food bank. She's like, you have to like really bring in, like start where you are and like do the resource mapping we were talking about. I really like that tool a lot as a place for people who are like, what's my community? Because I think it's a big word, and really being like, what does that even mean to me? And like, what's one place I can start building it? And I also want to shout out, Rebel Sydney Black, who's a friend of mine who passed this June. At the beginning of the pandemic, he created this tool called Pod Mapping for Mutual Aid that was specifically aimed at disabled folks who were trying to pod map during COVID. And we can provide the link and stuff like that. But like, I would say like those are two places to start. And then I want to get to alternatives to lying down and dying, and then I'll stop.
Okay, I want to talk more about the building community thing.
Please.
I think you brought up a lot of really interesting points. And one of the things that I really like about it, you know, talking about having like, you're broadening the idea of what counts as community, I think is really useful. And one of the things I realized is like a lot of times when I was younger, I was like, you all say community and you just mean the people that you like. Right. Mm-hmm. And that didn't make any sense to me. Like community seems like the people where you have a shared interest, or whether the shared interest is you live on the same block, or whether shared interest is an identity, or whether the shared interest is like an interest that you're trying to see change or whatever. It doesn't mean people you like. It's a different thing. Friends are the people I like. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And like, well, mostly. Just kidding. I love all of you.
Sure.
Actually, I mean, there's a lot of people I love that I don't always like. Anyway, so. I don't know. And so I think that one of the things that stuck out with me about what you're going to say, and I want to highlight, is the idea that, or maybe I'm misreading it, but like pick an issue to work around seems like a good, useful way. Like if you, especially if you like struggle to just like have friends, right? That's not like the thing that you're good at, but like, but maybe there's a thing that you want to work on, or like having that meetup where it's like, oh, all the following people who have, you know, have the following things in common, let's like meet up and talk about it. Or like, honestly, activism is a really good way to meet people and work closely with people about things. And it doesn't necessarily have to mean these are your friends, but they can be people where you rely on each other. And that doesn't have to be the same. I think about it a lot because I live in a fairly isolated and rural environment where there's not a lot of people around me who are culturally, whatever. It's not a lot about like out queer people where I live. There's not a lot of like punks. And I'm like, that's okay. I talk to my actual neighbors instead. I mean, some of, not all of them, but most of them, you know, and like they're who I would rely on in a crisis because they're right there. It doesn't mean that we have the same ideas about a lot of stuff, you know, but we have similar ideas like let's not die. Right. And so that's enough sometimes. Anyway, I just wanted to.
No, I really appreciate it. And I mean, that makes me kind of think about, like, when you're talking, I was like, yeah, you know, there's friends, there's communities, and then there's survival networks, which can include even, like, contacts, right? Like, because I just think about, like, yeah, like, I mean, if, like, what would I do right now if some shit happened? And I was like, I've got, like, long distance, you know, kin and like long-term friendships of and relationships of various kinds. And I also have, cause like I moved to where I live, which is like semi-rural, you know, but like definitely like more rural than where I've lived before. And I'm just like, yeah, I have a small number of friends, but there's like people who like, I know who I can, who are like neighbors who are like, we maybe don't know a shit ton about each other, but I could be like, hey, this thing, or hey, do you have water? Or hey, let's do this.
Totally.
I think it's a lot about thinking about like, is it long? Like, what are your goals? Is your goal intimacy? Is your goal survival? Is your goal friendship? Because you need different levels of trust and commonality depending on those things, right?
Yeah.
And I also think, and this is the thing too, I think a lot of times, because I've had people be like, well, I don't have community. Also, I've heard that.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of times it's in the context I hear it in is people being like, well, I have care needs, but I don't have any community. So then there's also the really big thorny question of need, and like being cared for is actually very complicated. It's very mm-hmm. risky. It's very vulnerable. It's not safe a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. It may feel a lot easier to just be like, I don't have any fucking needs. And so there's a lot, I will just say there's a lot of unpacking that needs to do around like, what would I need to be cared for? What are my lower risk needs that I need help with? What are my higher risk needs, right? Like, there's people who I can, there's some needs I have where I'm like, I don't need to trust you super, super deep politically or on an intimate level to let you do that. Yeah. There's certain needs where I'm like, that's only going to be people where we've really built a lot of fucking trust, because if this goes sideways, you could really fuck with me.
Yeah.
Right. So, and I think that when you're starting from nowhere, I think often where people get stuck is like, where I am feels like I have nobody and nothing. And I want to get to like the thing I've read about in utopic science fiction where, you know, it's Starhawk and everybody loves each other. And how the fuck do I get from A to B? And I think the solution is like, yeah, you're not going to get to fucking Fifth Sacred Thing right away. And that book is complicated.
God, I know. Never. It was very influential on my early
oh yeah,
life.
When I was 18, I just wanted to fucking move there. And now I'm like, oh God, this is embarrassing. There's some shit in here. I'm like, wow, everybody's mixed race, but everyone's black parents are dead. Wow. Cool. No one really thinks about race. I'm like, I'm going to throw up. And like, you know, BDSM is just violent. Okay, sorry. We're not going to talk
about Oh my God, I didn't remember that part.
Oh yeah, no, where they're just like, it's so violent. Like, we're just loving. And I wrote a really impassioned paper for school, because we actually had to read it in a college class I was in. And I was just like, why are they not into leather sexuality? And my professor was like, okay, 18-year-old. But yeah.
I mean, legit. Your 18-year-old self had a legitimate critique.
Yeah, no, there's a lot there. But jumping back, I guess it's just like, you know, like, and I think this feels like disabled wisdom too. It's like, what can you do with the spoons or the capacity you have? Like, what's one move you can make that's small? And then can you build on that?
Yeah.
But can I talk about alternatives to kind of dying? Yeah. Well, I mean, this is the thing. It's like, I'm a survivalist, but I'm not like anti-civilization in the ways that some people are. Like, I want meds, you know?
Right.
And I think that's the thing that like other Crips I know talk about a lot, which is like, you know, we're really against this way that some people, including some people who would like align themselves with like healing justice, are like, oh yeah, we just have to go back before colonialism, capitalism, and just everyone lived on herbs and it was great. And I was like, nah, bitch, I need surgery and meds. Like, I want it all. Like, I love non-Western pre-colonial traditional healing. Absolutely. And I've had friends who died because they didn't get their surgeries on time. Like, my friend LL died because nobody would give him a fucking kidney because they said he was too fat. And I'm just like, my Jesus good future involved. I mean, and he's one of millions, right?
No, like, I know. Yeah. But it's just, totally.
So like, my good future involves like, we have surgical suites and I'm just like, you know, honestly, also, a lot of times that worldview just seems so white to me, because I'm just like, listen, a lot of like global South places figure out how to have like field hospitals and medical care, right? In like really dire and like low resource situations.
No,
so
only
I'm sorry.
Europe has ever figured out surgery. Oh, no one else has done surgery until Europe showed up.
Yeah, not fucking ever. It's so fucking bad.
Said bite down on this stick while I saw your arm off.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess like, one thing I would just say is like, I would say that, and I would say like, you know, really, I want to like lift up and encourage people to like look at like and they can be hard to find, but like look at cultures, look at organizing initiatives where people are like, we can have our own ambulance, we can have our own like what, and when that's not there, to think about what would it mean to have medical care after the apocalypse, right? What would it mean to like make hormones, make drugs, like synthesize chemicals? And it's not impossible. I think that we're still in the in-between of like, okay, we got to figure out how to do that. But, you know, I'm thinking about like Ijeris Dixon, who's my friend and comrade, and, you know, we co-edited Beyond Survival together, which is a book we wrote that came out right at the beginning of the pandemic about like stories and strategies from how people are actually trying to create safety without the cops. Ijeris always talks about how they were like, in Louisiana, you know, in the South, you know, like in the 50s and 60s, and before, I believe, there were all kinds of Black run ambulance and 911 services because regular 911 wouldn't come to Black communities, right? Yeah. And they, I mean, something that I've heard them say a lot over the years is like, we don't have the people's ambulance yet, but we could.
Yeah.
And then it makes me like also jump to some friends of mine who were in Seattle, who were really active as like street medic crew during the rebellions after George Floyd was murdered by the police in, you know, 2020 in summer. And specifically in, as some people remember, Seattle managed to have like 16 square blocks like break off from the city for a while, the Capitol Hill Organized Front. And so what people don't know is like the cops were like, okay, fuck you. Like, we're not going to, if there's any 911 ambulance calls, we're not going to fucking let anyone go in there. So street medic crew had to deal with a lot of really intense situations.
Yeah.
And then after that, like a lot of those folks, like some folks were already nurses or EMTs, and a lot of the folks who were involved went to nursing school or EMT school and were like, and I don't know where it's at now, but they were like, we want to create, because right now in Seattle, there's, if somebody is having like a crisis on the street, like a medical or a mental health crisis or an altered state crisis, there's no non-911 like crisis response that you can call.
Right.
There's either like you go down the stairs to talk to somebody or there's the cops, right? And they were like, we can get a van, we can get medical equipment from eBay. And, you know, I don't know where they're at with that, but they were really organizing around like, yeah, we could get a defibrillator, we could get oxygen, we could get blood pressure cups, we could get fucking, you know, and I think that shit gets complicated in terms of like insurance and regulation and the state and the medical industrial complex. But I want us to keep thinking about that. I also, and then I'll wrap up because we have other questions to get to, but it also makes me think about, I mean, I don't know if folks are familiar with like Gretchen Felker Martin's like amazing science fiction book, Manhunt, right? Which is
about— I haven't
about,
read Manhunt yet.
Oh my God, it's so good. It's so fucking good. Okay, okay, so I won't give it away. But I just, for people who don't know, it's like, well, I mean, I'd say it's like the one kind of gender side book where, oh, a virus, you know, affects people with like certain like chromosomes or a certain that's not turfy. Because,
yeah.
You know, it's a book, because it's a book that, you know, she's trans and it's a book that centers trans women and non-binary communities. And there's like one or two trans masculine characters, but like the two main trans femme, like trans woman characters in the book, they're like, I mean, they have to, they're like, yeah, like we're going on raids to get, you know, hormones and like, you know, different like chemical drugs we need. And we're also figuring out how to synthesize them from herbs and different substances. And it's not easy. It's a struggle. But like, there are organized communities of trans women and allies that are fighting to do it. And
right.
I'm just like, yeah. And I mean, it's an amazingly well-written book and she's incredible and I fucking loved it. And it's just beautifully written and really just, sorry, I won't gush too much, but like, go read it. It's incredible. But I just really also appreciated it because she was like, yeah, like, of course we're going to get our hormones after the end of the world. Like, of course it's possible. And I will also, I have some criticisms of the ableism in it, but Emmy O'Brien and, fuck, I'm forgetting the second author's name, but everything for everyone, everyone for everything, that book.
Oh yeah.
I appreciated how in the good future society, they're like, our priority is making sure that like insulin and like chemical drugs and hormones are like accessible and free to everybody. And I was like, yeah. I don't know. I guess I would just like push people towards like, there are ways of imagining the future where we can defeat capitalism, but still have medical care of all kinds. We can have Reiki and acupuncture, and we can also have hormone surgery and transplants. And we might be doing it better because it's not controlled by fucking corporations and assholes.
Yeah.
Sorry. That's my soapbox. I will say in terms of people being like, that's really nice, but what about me? I would be like, you know, I mean, right now in like the war on trans America, there are so many people already who are like, yeah, I'm stockpiling meds. I'm like doing meds trading. I would say like, it goes back to what we started about, which is like, okay, what are your needs? Like, what are the things that you're worried will not be there if the world ends, right?
Right.
And we also need to recognize like the world's already ending and it's ended for some of us a bunch of times already. But like, I would be like, make that list and then really be like, all right, how do I get it? You know? And if I can't specifically get it, are there like backups that I can get? And it may be stuff that you can research on your own. It also might be stuff where it's like, okay, are there trans, repro justice, disability justice organizations nationally, globally, locally that you can hit up and be like, What are folks' thoughts about this? Are there ways that we can resource share? Because I think it's about pills. I think it's also about durable medical equipment. So in terms of like stuff that requires like power to live, like I think about generators and I think about generator shares. And I think about things like there's a story, you know, when Hurricane Sandy hit New York 10 years ago, there were a whole bunch of us where there's a guy, Nick, who's in community, who physically disabled guy, 13th floor accessible apartment, you know, the lights went out, you know, really dependent on like, you know, like electricity to like change out the batteries on his ventilator. There's a whole crew of disabled folks, like people walked up and down those fucking stairs every 8 hours to take the spent batteries, figured out, hey, you know what's the lowest power? The fucking fire department. People were walking down recharging the batteries every 8 hours, and it was allies. Yeah. It was ambulatory. It was like disabled people who could walk. It was fucking hard, but people were like, we're not, Nick and his friends were like, we're not just going to die.
Yeah.
Right.
Totally.
Like we're needed. So I want to shout out that. And I also like just for possibility modeling, I really want to, one other place I want to shout out is, an org that used to be known as Portlight, but was now known as the Center for Inclusive Disaster Strategies, which is a disabled-led organization that is about, like, yeah, when there's a climate or other disaster, like, they figure out ways of getting, like, accessible fucking evacuation, like, you know, methods to places. Because they know, we know there's millions of examples of people who are just left to die in nursing homes, or like, oops, the bus doesn't have a ramp, or... You know, I really want to name that during Katrina, some people may know about, you know, the situation with the nursing home that was there, where a lot of folks who were wheelchair users or had high care needs were fucking, like, they were killed by medical staff because the medical staff were like, we're going to actually euthanize these folks without their knowledge or consent. Yeah, no, there was actually a movie on HBO about it, I think semi-recently, because we can't, that's easier than figuring out how to fucking get people in the medevac, right?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, the Partnership for Inclusive Disaster Strategies, like, I'm still getting to know them, but I have friends who are involved. And they're like, yeah, we're aware this is an issue. So, like, yeah, let's work with the fucking Cajun fucking Navy to, like, make sure that, like, you can get folks with different bodies onto, like, evac boats. Like, let's figure out what, you know, disabled survival looks like. And I will just say, and this is the last thing I swear, like, for me, you know, I mean, we all know water is important. Like, I can't lift 54 pounds. Guess what? So can't, which is like, you know, a 7 gallon, right? Like 5 or 7 gallon, whatever. I'm just like, yeah. So I can actually have smaller like jugs of water that I can transport. And like, I have a bug out plan, but I also have a real shelter in place plan because I'm just like, yeah, my apartment's accessible for me. So yeah, I've got a shit ton of water right here and I'll be good for a while. And I also have a plan B for like, okay, I've got my filtration equipment. So like when that runs out, I'm close to some water sources where I can go and I can filter that shit. And that's me thinking about what works for my body. Think about what works for yours and then plan out from that. Okay. Well, I'll really stop talking now.
No, but there's so much there. Like even just to go to the weight of water, right?
Right.
The thing that I ran across that I'm like, I'm reasonably able-bodied and such like that. Right. But I live alone. And so obviously there's this like specific thing where like, well, one, I mean, ableness is always like a temporary position. Like there's going to be a period.
You're gonna get fucking disabled. You're gonna get fucking disabled.
Like it literally happens to, unless you like, I don't know, die very quickly, very suddenly, probably violently, you're gonna go through a period of disability in your life, you know?
Right.
And and so okay, my argument is that machismo is anti-prepping. And one of the ways I would say is that like there's now, I think, okay, so cement bags, they come in like 50-pound bags traditionally.
Right.
But now there's more and more, I think, there seems to be more and more 30-pound bags, right?
Right.
And I used to be like, well, whatever, I can lift 50-pound bags, so I should carry the 50-pound bag. And then I'm like, well, that's not a helpful way to look at it. Like it is far better for me to just have 30-pound bags of cement because they're easier to carry. And, like, I'll get tired less. And I, you know, at the time that I was pouring these bags, I lived up up a hill about, probably the equivalent of a 7-story walk up to this cabin that I was building, right? And so I had to carry each and every one. It was way nicer that I carried 30-pound bags. And like, and if your preparedness doesn't include the fact that your level of ability will change in different situations, then it's not very good preparedness. And and so like, I don't know. I mean, like most of my water jugs are 4 or 5 gallon jugs. I use jerry cans. I think most of them are 5 gallon. And I hate the 6 gallon ones and the 7 gallon ones. They're just heavy and annoying. And it's like, I can lift them, but there's no reason why I should. unless I'm like specifically working on lifting weights. And then the other thing that you talked about that I think about a lot, you know, is this idea. Does your version of disaster mean that every doctor dies? Like, you know, or like, does your version of disaster mean everyone who's ever made insulin dies? Like,
yeah,
like, seriously. It's possible. Sure, you could have like 90. If almost everyone on Earth dies, then everything is a little different. But like, most disasters don't actually. Most disasters destroy ways of living and large numbers mm-hmm. of people, but not mm-hmm. the majority of people. Right? Mm-hmm. Most people survive most disasters, mm-hmm. And people are like, well, our organizational systems are what produce insulin. And like, no, people produce insulin mm-hmm. and they use organizational systems with which to mm-hmm. do it. But different mm-hmm. organizational systems can also produce insulin. Like mm-hmm. different organizational systems can use the same infrastructure sometimes and make the things that we rely on. And it like came up with this like whole thing where people on the internet were like, if you're an anarchist, you hate disabled people because in anarchy, you can't have insulin. And you're like,
that's gross.
It is a complete misunderstanding of anarchism. It is not a lack mm-hmm. of organization. It is a different type of organization.
Anarchy is responsibility.
Yeah, Totally. That's why people don't like it. People are like afraid of it because then they actually have to. It's the accepting no one is coming to save us except us. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, I love that way of framing it. And it also annoys anarchists when you tell them this too.
Oh, well, listen, I mean, like, you know, so I worked at Modern Times Books, which was, you know, it's no longer around, but was like a long time, like anarchist and anti-authoritarian radical bookstore in the Bay. And we had the only public toilet in all of the Mission because everybody else was like, no, you got to buy something. And in my interview, they were like, how will you make the store better? And I was like, I will make the bathroom not smell horrible. Because, you know, it was just like, it was like a bus. I mean, everyone was pissing in there. And so I taped up a sign that said, anarchy is responsibility. Like, if you spray the toilet with urine, please wipe it up together.
We can have
the toilet. And somebody called me out and was like, that's capitalist. And I was like, no, just wipe your piss up, man. If you can't wipe your piss up, we're not going to make the revolution. Like, come on. They got pissed at me about that then too. Yes. But yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good point. And it's like, you know, I mean, I think that it does point to, you know, I think a structural problem in a lot of our movements, which is like, yeah, we need more people who like know some basics of like chemistry and like can synthesize stuff. Like, that's, you know, we need more people who've gone to some kind of science or engineering school who can like, you know, figure out how sewage works and how you synthesize insulin and how you synthesize hormones and like basic surgery. And I think there's a lot of hopefulness because maybe it's just the folks I hang out with, but I have a fair number of friends who are like, yeah, I'm going to be a nurse practitioner. I can give you an abortion. Yeah. I can sew up your wound. I can help you figure out this thing. And I'd love for there to be more of us who can go to PA school or know more than that. And I also think, yeah, we need to, I mean, of course it's like a longer range strategy, but it's like, yeah, some chemistry school would be great. And like, you know, recruiting folks who know some STEM stuff and who are like, yep, we can, you know, we can build it. We have the technology, I think is super important.
Yeah.
And also, but I really thank you for saying like, what in like your idea of disaster do all the doctors die? Cause like, no, they're not going to fucking all die.
Yeah.
Like, it is a problem that, you know, under capitalism and ableist, racist, white supremacist, sexist society, you know, medical school is really expensive and hard to get through and it'll fucking kill, like make you half dead. But it doesn't mean there aren't like some progressive PAs and doctors out there who are like, yeah, like we can figure it out. And it does not mean that the entire national medical stock is going to disappear overnight. It's not.
Totally.
Like, it's really not.
Yeah.
There's a lot of insulin out there. It may not seem like it because it's hard to get because it's expensive.
Right.
But like, there's a shit ton of meds out there and it's not all going to run out right away.
Yeah. And it does have a impressive shelf life overall. The dosages will change as it gets older because it becomes less effective. But like,
sure.
Is a hard to get, but is actually more stockpilable than most disposable or like consumable goods. So there's one more big topic that I really want to talk to you about. Originally, we're going to do the whole first half about it. Mm-hmm. And basically, I want to talk about the state of COVID and how it ties into disability and preparedness. And I want to talk about like how we as both a society and then also as movements like are and are not handling COVID in responsible ways and like where we're at with it right now.
Yeah. Well, sometimes I think it's the Crips that are going to inherit the earth because, you know, I mean, part of the anarchy is responsibility thing is, you know, what's responsibility and anarchy? Public fucking health.
Yeah.
You know, and it's the irony where, you know, some, like, so, you know, as of this recording, the CDC and ACIP just like authorized like the newest variation of, you know, the boosters and the Missouri, let me find this because it is just so fucking horrible. And I was like, is this real? And they were like, yeah. So yeah, Triangle Mask Brigade, which is like a Durham rally and Chapel Hill mask, you know, just like mask distro and COVID activist group. Mm-hmm. They had posted, hold on, the Missouri Department of Health, their Instagram literally posted a thing that was like, COVID vaccines will be available in Missouri soon. And then they say, I shit you not, if you're into that sort of thing. If not, just keep scrolling. And I was like,
oh my God,
this can't be real. And they were like, no, it's fucking real. It's literally, and they're like, I was screaming at the person who's, there's literally an epidemiologist, but who's, you know, yeah, like, you know, eugenicist and fasci. And okay, so what I mean by this, what I mean is that like anarchy is responsibility and that everyone I know who's involved in disabled organizing, like COVID safety organizing, that's like, I'm like, shit, I hate to look like a tin hatter, but I'm just like, the CDC's abandoned us. You know, it sucks. Yeah. They're just like, oh, what COVID? What surge? What data? We've made it so there is none. Oh, everyone's sick, but oh, what could that be? It is the rest of us who are like, it sucks that we've had to become citizen scientists and public health people with no budget to be like, wear a mask, use, you know, nasal spray, like use, you know, use this particular kind of mouth, use CPC mouthwash. Here's what you do when you get sick. Like here's, you know, all of that.
Yeah.
But we are the ones who are working towards collective safety and keeping ourselves and each other safe.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm answering your question. I just basically am just like TLDR, those of us who are COVID conscious and who are not just continuing to keep ourselves safe individually, but who are like putting out tools are going to be the ones that save all of us that end up getting safe.
My mom likes this one. My mom likes this one. My mom likes this one. But don't let that put you off.
Making space for women's voices, the voice of her say, the voice of her say, the voice of her say, coming at ya every Wednesday from 6 to 7.
Previously broadcast program.